or the future generations that would follow would have the right access to that herd.
The second question that I have, you really didn't discuss your what you saw or envisioned to be in that international agreement, but I was wondering if you had any thoughts or what did you see in relationship to commenting on oil exploration and development in the Arctic National Wildlife Range and also on Venati, the Venati Reservation?
Well, that area there, as I understand it, is, in our view, very sensitive because of the calving grounds and the staging grounds for the caribou before they migrate, they gather in that area. What we see is that those areas should be held off from any kind of development at all. For instance, in the North Yukon, we take the position that, first of all, that a park be established in North Yukon, we've got that. That also there be a land use planning regime set up for the North Yukon where oil exploration or resource development or hydrocarbon developments up there would be subject to an environmental screening process. First of all, whether it's in the national interest, whether it's in the interest of that area, and what the environmental and socioeconomic impacts are that would result from that, and secondly, what measures or mitigative measures should be put in place to protect the habitat and the caribou itself. So I think in terms of the wildlife range there, we would look to the Alaskan Native communities to look after the interests of the herd itself. And we've talked about it in the past, and in the next meeting that we see coming forward in November, those kind of issues should be discussed more amongst those communities as to what position or strategy should be taken to ensure that the interests of the caribou is looked after, including the habitat.
Maria.
Yes, I'll direct my question to Jonathan Solomon. With the bowhead whales, we've been severely impacted by CODIS, and from what I understand, the North Slope Borough recommended not to include any language related to CODIS in the management plan. I'm not sure how the state is handling management in terms of how many people can take, or what kind of management are you looking at?
Yeah, I think when we set this quota thing, I think in the agreement, we only said that quota will become in effect if there's a decline in the herd. Today, on the state of Alaska Fish and Game, sets a quota, a type of a quota, only saying that if this herd is hunted by people from other areas, that you can only take 3 caribou south of the Yukon. That's the only quota I know of at this point.
Hugh Monahan.
I have just a couple of general comments to elaborate on what Bob was saying. There's a basic theme in Canadian land claim negotiations, at least in the NWT, that is perhaps distinct from the situation in Alaska here that we should maybe understand as we discuss this sort of an issue. And that is that Native people, at least in the NWT, it is assumed that they will continue to have access for the purposes of hunting, trapping, and fishing to all unoccupied Crown lands in the Northwest Territories. Unoccupied is a little unclear as to what exactly that means in law. Our case law is very limited. But in in fact, you can assume that almost the entire of the Northwest Territories is unoccupied Crown land, with the exception of the villages themselves and the odd small area. The only limitation placed on Native access to resources within that geographical area is based on either conservation, in other words, to maintain populations, or public safety. So the principle then is that that also applies to all conservation lands, territorial parks, national parks, or whatever. So within that notion, what in effect we're striving for is that we want consistency in management regimes in throughout the hinterland, whether it's inside or outside of conservation areas. Consistency in management programs and also access by users, since particularly in the Arctic, we're dealing with populations that move over very broad areas, populations of wildlife, as well as hunters. So you've got a regime that is fairly simple. There are some exceptions to that, but in general, it's a very, very open system currently, and we envision that carrying on in the future beyond land claims.
David, and then Steve.
How is it possible for the unoccupied, or is it possible for the unoccupied Crown lands to become occupied in the future?
Well, of course, it would take a lawyer to ask that question. As I mentioned, we have very little case law. There are some narrow development corridors that could perhaps be described as being occupied, but the mere creation of a conservation area does not make it occupied Crown land. There has been some case law in the Yukon recently, which we've been looking at, and I suspect these fellows are about to comment on.
Dave Porter, did you want to add something on that?
In the Yukon a few years ago, there was a case where two of our people were charged for taking caribou in the game sanctuary. At the magistrate court level decision, those people were found guilty for hunting on occupied Crown land, and that was the central theme as to the dispute in terms of the legal arguments. And it went to the Supreme Court of the Yukon and was overturned at that level, and a game sanctuary as a designation in terms of land use was not deemed to have been found to be an occupation of the land. So it would follow that a lot of the similar designations, including possibly parks, may not restrict the ability of our people to, at the present time, in terms of how the law is stated in Yukon, to go out and practice their hunting rights.
Is assuming the Crown land is not set aside as a park or something else specific for habitat protection or whatever, is it possible for Crown lands to be used for non-renewable resource development? And does that then constitute occupancy, or is that really addressed?
In the NWT, based on my current understanding, only the very local area of surface lease would be considered occupied. Uh-huh. But the mere fact of letting out 5,000 square miles subsurface does not constitute alienation for the purposes of this discussion.
Okay, good. I have a couple of questions, maybe to Mr. Matander. I understand that you're in the process of negotiating an agreement, but does the agreement envision some substantial role for the native population or beneficiaries or their representatives in the management decision making, or is their participation to be one of access to the decision makers, advisory capacities, and the like?
In terms of game management or the land use?
Game management and land use. And
there is guaranteed participation in both areas. In terms of the game management board, we've got 50% of the management south of 6530. In terms of the land use planning, it ranges from a minimum 25% south to 50% in the north.
Depending on the amount of native population in a given area, is that
yes.
variable?
Maybe it's minimum guarantee of 25. So it could go up, but it can't go less than 25.
After coffee, we'll lay this out in a more clearer fashion.
Well, one comment, just, I mean, I just want to get rid of this, but it does seem to me that there is a big difference in the approach or the philosophy of settlement in Canada, which Mr. Monahan has discussed, and I was intrigued to look at the statements of purpose of the COPE settlement, and it contrasts markedly with the statements of purpose of the Claims Act.
Yeah. Well, Dave Porter was suggested coffee, and before we break, let me make an attempt to link what we were talking about yesterday with what we've been talking about today. It seemed to me yesterday that we were all struggling with the notion of an indigenous society dependent on subsistence, its moral and ethical and cultural features marked by subsistence, and that enterprise threatened by laws devised for every purpose except the enhancement and let alone the restoration of subsistence. And that led Tom Lawner, among others, to suggest that the present network of laws and regulations in the long run would not enable subsistence to survive, but would inevitably lead to its further decline. It was suggested by many that that was the inevitable result of this interface between two societies, two cultures, and so on. And we turned today to see yesterday when Tony Vasca and Harold Spark talked about the Hooper Bay Agreement, and again today when Marie Adams and Burton Rexford talked about the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission and now the International Porcupine Caribou Commission, to instances where Native people have themselves at the local level decided to take the initiative to protect that culture, that the resources it depends on, and that way of life. And I think that what we've heard today is reassuring. Before we, or after coffee, I think that we should, as I suggested, hear about the approach of the COPE claim towards subsistence, because, and the Yukon claim towards subsistence, because of course we've heard of how they're struggling with this international caribou herd, but they have all kinds of other things they're dealing with in terms of fish and wildlife. And it might be useful to us to hear about the provisions that COPE has negotiated and that CYI has, I understand, rejected. So let's take a break for coffee and then return.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, before that, I requested at the beginning of this thing that this traditional council with sovereign power have the last say on this issue.
Right. Yes, please.
Mr. Chairman, yesterday there were certain issues brought up concerning the rights of the people that depend on subsistence in the state of Alaska. Don Mitchell mentioned that land claims done certain things. Right or wrong, it did. But it also put us in the arena of the political system of the Western world. When we learned this thing, what we call the political arena, we learned it hard, but we learned it well. With the chief of a traditional council, somebody said when they have meetings, there was no motions made or motion passed. It is very important that the people outside of our own culture understands how these decisions are made. The traditional people of the state of Alaska deals with issues by consensus. It is the duty after consensus is met, it is the duty of the traditional chief to make that decision. Decision is not made by motions, only the discussion to come to a point of consensus. We live this way because we don't want our chief to go to a meeting to make that decision to be questioned on his authority. Even the President of the United States cannot make that kind of statement. When I make a decision for my people, it is with a consensus of them people that cannot be questioned. And there were issues brought up about the Claims Act and what it done. It opened a lot of doors to Native people, which never wasn't open to Native people before. Maybe that's a good side, but there's also a lot of bad side of it, where we have point by point, section by section, we have to deal with that every day and protect these things. And that's why we're here today. As the traditional chief of the Yukon Flats, my people are meeting in Chalkeetsuk today, discussing 1991. We have heard a lot of things about 1991. Our villages became corporations. And all of a sudden, we're in 12 region corporations. If you look at the boundary lines of these region corporations, the boundary lines of these region corporations were decided 10,000 years ago by our own people. Within them areas, and I come from the Tenachi Toyan region, 1991 issues, the way my people in the Yukon Flats see it, the village people are not in jeopardy. Only the region corporation, because their shareholders, majority are at large people without a village. You cannot take or discuss the stock issues of these corporations without splitting what is the village corporation and what's a region corporation. I asked my own people, in 1991, would you sell your stocks? They said, yes, we'll sell the Doyon stock, but we will not sell our own village corporation stock. Because the majority of these people live right there. They subsist on them lands adjoining the village corporations. In 1973, during the land selection, the village people were smart enough. When they done their village corporation selection, they selected everything that they subsist on. And we took it to our region corporations that these are the lands we're going to apply for. And they said, well, we get less land this way. Well, let's make a deal. We did. We checkerboard the the 25 townships for the maximum land to the Doyon region. But we also got a signed contract agreement that when these things, when these lands are conveyed, that the village corporation will manage these lands. If there's going to be all development within the Yukon Flat, which Doyon region right now wants, the Doyon board, but they cannot get a letter on non-objection from these village corporations. If there's oil there, same thing. Right now, and the whole nation says, there's a surplus of oil. So why should we drill for oil on the Arctic Wildlife Range or the Village Corporation lands? Because there's a big surplus of oil. If the United States and the nation got 120 years of surplus oil, then we tell them, we'll drill for oil 120 years from now. But nobody listens. Because everybody wants to get rich in a short time. And it was brought up about the wages that's earned in these villages. Average wages cash into my village, Sport Yukon, is about $700 a year that they earn working, as you call it. But every year, Native cultures are practiced. We call it potlatches. We got a potlatch when somebody dies. We got a memorial potlatch for our elders that died years ago. These people that make $400, $700 a year have a memorial potlatch worth $50,000. The Western culture does not understand this. So how can they understand our subsisting way of life? It's very important when we talk about our ecosystem with animals. And I want you to note, with the Porcupine Caribou Herd Commission, it's made up of both sides of the country, and all of this except for Katuvik speaks the same language. We communicate, we have meetings in our own language. The only village that don't understand is our Eskimo brothers from Katuvik. That whole range speaks the same language because they are in with the ecosystem with the Porcupine Caribou herd. And I want you people to understand that. We're not taking anything away from anybody. We're not taking anything away that didn't belong to us in the first place. And as Native people in the whole country know, that when our country calls us, we answer. And we're ready to do that. We're pleading and saying, here, we're here. We're the experts on these issues. Use us. Nobody have came forth yet say that would you come join us in these things about the trouble of this country. But we're ready. We've been ready for thousands of years. Our doors are open to anybody that wants to become a subsistent user. We don't deny anybody that. And this is the way that Native people do. I share what's on my table with you. That's what it means, subsistent. When I share with you, then my heart is happy, so is yours. And this is the way of subsistent way of life. We kind of sometimes go around it and forget some of our native leaders, ourselves, sometimes forget who we're serving. But we're reminded when we go home, every day of our life. And it's very important to me that these kind of meetings where you let the indigenous people lead the discussion is very, very, I had good feelings today on it. Now we are given a chance to be asked the questions instead of us asking the question through the other side. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you very much. Well, we'll take a break for coffee and for a few minutes. Of material.
Yeah, well, I learned something. Yeah.
Well, the great thing about having people here in person is it brings all these documents to life.
Yeah,
including Steve's paper. Mm-hmm. Including Steve's paper. Well, it does. It's.
Negotiations in Canada are just focusing on subsistence and control of the resources, control of habitat, and I was really struck by the preambles to the COPA agreement, comparing that to the preambles to the Claims Act. It's
just,
you got three little sentences here, and they say, you know, it's all going to be protected.
Yeah.
See what I'm here.
Well, let's take our seats and take another crack at this. Willie Goodwin's coming tonight, so he will talk about Nana tomorrow. And Well, I'm about to make a slight change in our plans. Dick Spaulding, who's a lawyer from Yellowknife, is here. He is a lawyer working for the Dene Nation and the Métis Negotiating Committee, and he has to leave tonight. So I thought I would ask him to open the discussion this afternoon and tell us about the approach of the Dene and the Métis towards subsistence values and subsistence hunting and fishing rights. So, Dick, you have the floor then.
Thank you. This roundtable comes at a very opportune time for the Dene and Métis. They started to negotiate the issues of wildlife harvesting and management in April 84, and they haven't finished. So this discussion is going to give us the opportunity to review the positions that we're developing and look at them in perhaps a larger perspective than one sometimes does when you're working on a week-to-week basis at the table. I should say that I'm another one of the mechanics in the crowd. I don't have, obviously, any mandate to state political positions or negotiating positions on behalf of my client. The opinions I'm going to be expressing are my own opinions, and any description that I'm giving of what I see as the Dene Métis view of things is only my own description, and I take full responsibility for any misrepresentations that might involve. To give some background on the Dene Métis claim, the Dene and Métis are the Aboriginal people of the Mackenzie Valley Basin. Today, their population is roughly 14,000. They number roughly half of the voting population of their claim area. The government of the Northwest Territories is a native majority government. However, when you compare the eastern part of the territories to the western part, you find that the Inuit are in a predominant majority and expect to continue to be in that majority for some time to come, whereas the Dene and Métis are roughly half of the population now, and see it as quite possible that they are not far away from a minority position. And they are developing their positions in the Aboriginal Claims Forum from that perspective, a perspective which assumes that they will have significant clout with the ballot box, but not majority clout in the long run. They have been negotiating their claims since the early 70s. For most of that decade, their negotiations concerned political rights. The Government of Canada, for most of that period, refused to openly negotiate political rights with the Dene and Métis, with the exception of a period during 1977. It was only when the federal government in 1981 agreed to support the establishment of constitutional forums to deal with political development involving both the native organizations and representatives of the territorial governments in the eastern and western Arctic that the Dene and Métis decided to turn their attention at the Aboriginal claims table to issues concerning lands and resources. The first issue that was dealt with at the claims table was eligibility, the definition of the collective that would be participating in the settlement. And Bob Gamble is quite right in saying that the first substantive issue that the Dene Métis are dealing with in terms of land and resources is wildlife harvesting and management, and that has only begun this past April. To give some background on the regulatory system, some of the problems with it in the Mackenzie Basin, just a few general comments. I think the first thing to note in contrast with the Alaska situation is that the Dene and Métis have had most of their traditional land area covered by treaties since the turn of the century, 1899 for part of the claim area, 1920 for the other part. And these treaties recognized special rights for native people to harvest. I think it's worth mentioning that the recognition did not limit itself to subsistence harvest. It included hunting, fishing, and trapping. And further, that with respect to hunting and fishing, it recognized what was the Dene Métis' usual vocation to hunt and fish. And at the time, the usual vocation of the Dene and Métis people did include some exchange with primarily Hudson's Bay traders of meat and as well supply of meat to Roman Catholic missions. I would say that there is a similarity between the regulatory, the history of the regulatory regime in the territories and Alaska, as it's been characterized yesterday, in that there has generally been not a great deal of restriction on native access alone to renewable resources. There have been enough instances of it, however, to make the Dene Métis aware that they need protection from the use of authority in the name of scientific management or in the name of competing users to restrict their access to wildlife. There have been cases of accusations of severe over-harvesting, particularly the Beverly Kamenuriak caribou herd, which purported to be made on a scientific basis and were later found not to have been valid, that the caribou count had been wrong. Those kinds of accusations have produced the kinds of pressures for restrictions on native harvesting that people in Alaska have encountered. I'd like to break my discussion of the Dene Métis approach to the negotiation of this issue into five parts. One concerns the definition of subsistence and the attempt to describe the basic right that the Dene Métis are seeking. The second concerns how it might help to consider that a property right, and also the ways in which it might not help. The third is management, and I'd like to deal with that in terms of self-regulation and also in terms of participation by the Dene Métis in public management through joint management boards. The fourth is the supply side, the habitat protection and productivity of the resource. The agreement that is being negotiated presently by the Dene Métis doesn't cover much of that. Much of that necessarily includes questions of the creation of conservation areas and parks, land use planning, land ownership, which are going to be dealt with in separate agreements, but I do have some things to say about that. And lastly, the perspective of the Dene Métis on the importance of measures to strengthen and enhance the renewable resource economy, investment in that economy. I think it's fair to say that the preservation and enhancement of the traditional way of life of the Dene Métis is their priority in the negotiations of the wildlife harvesting and management position and of their overall settlement. And I think it's also fair to say that they found their claim to their tradition, to protection of their traditional way of life on the basis that have been outlined yesterday, on a moral basis, on a political legal basis, on a cultural basis, and also on an economic basis. I would say, though, that I think the definition of subsistence that was discussed yesterday and is outlined generally in Steve Langdon's paper falls short in the economic dimension in terms of the Dene Métis approach to the basic right that they want to see recognized. They see themselves as having had an economy that was self-sufficient prior to contact, and it was self-sufficient based at that time on subsistence. Since contact, however, it has been a mixed economy. For most of the period since contact actually introduced exchange and cash in a significant way to the Dene Métis, they've still been able to produce cash through activities based on renewable resources, and that's primarily trapping. After the Second World War, when trapping price, when fur prices went way down, and other forces ended up putting people in settlements and encouraging people to rely on the wage economy, there has been less reliance on the renewable resource economy as a means of self-sufficiency. But the Dene Métis are looking at their settlement as a means to make them as self-sufficient as they can possibly be on the basis of renewable resources, so that they are looking for a right which will permit them to not only subsist on renewable resources, but to earn cash from the production and development of renewable resources. And they are also looking at a right that will give them preferences and priorities in that area, not only so that they can produce cash, but so that they can control how competitors develop renewable resources. To paraphrase that, then, I think that I don't think that this wording is perfect, but I think to compare what they see as the basic right that they're pursuing to what Commissioner Berger mentioned yesterday as a preferential native subsistence right, I would say perhaps that the Dene Métis are talking about a preferential right to produce and develop renewable resources. Now, does it help at all to talk about this in terms of a property right? I think it does in some respects.
Just before you go on, what do you, when you say renewable resources, do you mean anything besides fish and game?
The position that's being negotiated right now deals almost exclusively with fish and game, but the Dene Métis will expect to be taking a similar position with respect to timber and plants as well. One respect in which it helps to think of this as a property right in terms of their approach is that they are looking to exclusive rights to some species, exclusive rights to some areas for all species, areas outside parks and conservation areas, and areas separate and apart from any lands that they might gain fee simple title to. So that as an owner of property generally has the right to say who else can or cannot use that property, the Dene Métis are looking at a harvesting right that, at least with respect to some species in some areas, would give them that kind of authority. And they see that as providing them essentially with two things. One is protection from competing users, and control over competing uses. Not necessarily, they are not necessarily assuming that exclusive rights mean that there will not be permission granted to other harvesters to harvest for sport or subsistence purposes, but that the Dene and Métis will be in a position to manage that kind of use. They are thinking of some qualifications on that kind of exclusivity, and they are qualifications that might apply in the case where the Dene Métis have an exclusive right to an area or a species and are not exercising that right. And those kind of qualifications would then possibly permit others in some seasons of the year, some of the less critical seasons of the year, to harvest those resources or those areas. And as well to apply for permission to the local Dene Métis committee responsible for that area to harvest when perhaps the community isn't using that area, and judging by their traditional conservation practices, they think that that area can be used. Another respect in which I think it might help to think about this as a property right is that it is seen as an inherited right. It's seen as an inherited right that applies to the entire collective of people who are eligible for the settlement. It does not depend upon the lifestyle of those people. It wouldn't depend on the technology of their harvest. It wouldn't depend upon where they live within the claim area. It wouldn't depend upon whether they exercise that right often or infrequently. It would be seen as a birthright. Another respect in which I think it helps to think of it as a property right, and I've referred to this in my general comments, is that the holders of these rights would have considerable discretion in how they use them, in other words, how they use the harvest. And I think the main importance of having that kind of discretion from the point of view of the Dene Métis is to protect the subsistence priority, which is their priority. But it also would provide them with the option to use the resource for other purposes, including what some people might even call sport, but primarily commercial purposes. And in our discussions, we are talking about exclusive rights to commercial licenses in some respects, and with respect to other kind of economic uses of wildlife, rights of first refusal. We're talking about preferential opportunities to farm, to ranch, to retail, to manufacture.
Sorry, to farm.
Fur farming.
Fur farming.
Yeah.
And what's ranching?
Ranching, perhaps, of buffalo. There is a reindeer preserve mostly outside of the